Hi, and welcome to the Audio Engineering Podcast number 12. 12 today, and sorry about the echoey room, but I'm at the gym. Shay and I thought we'd crack one out in the form of a podcast.
Crack a podcast out.
And so I've just snuck into a meeting room. So if this finishes quickly, it's because somebody's come in and sussed me out.
I told you where to go.
For the facilities. But we're going to talk today about, it's a question from a listener, and they want to know, how do you EQ certain elements of tracks? Mm-hmm. So I think this is probably one for Shay again to kick off on, because he has a little bit more control over the EQ of tracks. If you're EQing, what types of EQ would you use, first of all?
Well, I mean, because I'm coming at it from the mixing point of view, I've got more control, obviously. I'll be able to have, say it's a guitar, I'll be able to have the guitar stem. If it's a synth, I'll be able to have a synth stem. It's always going to be plug-in EQs. I rarely use outboard EQs unless it's on a mix bus. So it's things like the FabFilter Pro-Q, and it's mainly sort of tight notch subtractive EQ on each thing, because I find making sure that you've gotten rid of something or gotten rid of the bad frequencies before you add anything is going to make the sound as good as it possibly can. Obviously, if you're taking away frequency, you're taking away amplitude as well. So you're always going to be giving yourself more and more headroom the whole time, getting it to sit in the mix a little bit nicer, giving it its own place in the mix, less cloud.
Is it important to watch how much you are taking away, though? Because obviously with anything that you take away, it's going to mean that you're taking away some of the flavour of the recording, the original recording, when you're mixing, rather than as you're recording, getting that sound right. If the sound is right in the first place, then you shouldn't really have to do anything, should you? Ideally. But it never is. So it's obviously a way up between the two, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's if it was done properly, but if it was done perfectly, the recording, there's not much you're going to have to do. But when you're taking stuff away, you're not just taking away for the sake of it. You're only taking away bits that you feel need to be taken away. So it's not like you're getting rid of stuff that is going to be needed. All you're going to be doing, and it's really tight notch EQs. So things like resonant frequencies, like piano, I always do it. Piano, you always get a resonant frequency, especially if it's like a synth piano, like a software instrument piano emulation, especially when it's got reverb and stuff on it. You always find certain notes give you bad resonance in certain areas. So it's just literally fine-tuning exactly where those are on the graphic of one of the EQs you use and just pulling it out before you think of accentuating it, before you think of adding anything to it. And it's the same with everything. It's the same with every single element, whether it's synthesizers, basses, vocals, anything. Like subtractive EQ, I mean, recently a couple of students brought sort of sessions in to get sort of like mix reviews wise, and just looking at it and looking at the EQs, and it's just all additive, like 8 dB here, massive big curves, and it's like, and they're saying that it's not powerful enough, like they can't get enough power out of it, and they're just redlining. So just bypass all the EQs, put them back to default, notch a few bits out, then it sounds more powerful, and you've got loads of headroom. And it, takes a while to sort of get your head around it, like to make something sound better and bigger, you take stuff away from it. But all you're doing is getting rid of the areas that are going to be masking other things, so you don't end up being in the game of adding and adding and adding to compensate for something else. If you take something away, you're making room for something else. There's no compensation, or there's no like compromise. There's no real compromise when you're subtracting. There's only sort of giving more room, giving more space.
Yeah, it goes back to what we always say about space and making room for the instrument against another instrument. Yeah. Otherwise, you have clashing harmonics and just trying to push everything as loud as you can just never really works, does it? Yeah. You're turning it up, basically. You're turning up what is already a bad sound. Yeah.
But I mean, from your point of view, from, say, the mastering side, yours is probably the opposite to me, where you're doing the same kind of EQ but more additive, but in really small increments. Is that right?
Yeah, and a lot wider. Yeah. So I'm not doing as notchy as you would do. I'm doing it a lot wider. I'm kind of painting with a brush, if you like.
Yeah,
big
broader
sweep.
Strokes.
Yeah, exactly. And pinpointing tracks within mastering, you can pull out certain stuff, especially with MSEQ. It's quite dangerous, but you can pop a vocal out if you put a shelf on at 1.7, mm-hmm. which the shelf is quite broad, and obviously you're taking it all the way up. That then goes all the way up. But if you're doing that on the mid channel on a track, then it can pop the vocal out. It will pop everything else out that's around that kind of mid range. But you know, that's where the around that area is where your ear is most susceptible to brightness. So it, by popping that out a little bit, it does add a little bit of extra excitement around 1.7K. So it kind of makes the rest of the track, because it's so broad, it's not as spiky in that area.
Yeah, and the thing is, but you're not adding silly amounts of gain, are you? You're adding like maybe 1.5, 2 dB. Yeah, we'll say that.
Not even 1.5.
Yeah.
I never would add 1.5 at 1.7K at a mid band, because that's just the crazy torque.
Mm. So that's another thing. It's
changed the mix far too much, and somebody's obviously spent time.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, if the mix is a complete disgrace, then obviously you've got to do whatever you've got to do. But a lot of the times, you know, especially these days, I think a lot of people's mixes are so much better now, because there's a lot of information out there for people to get better.
Mm-hmm.
There's good software. You know, they can basically get a really good mix. I would say most of the stuff that comes in is a million times better than it used to be a long time ago. Even when people were on massive mixing desks, the stuff sounds so much better than it used to, because they had too many options in the past, as in things that can add noise and make the mix sound bad. Now they can mix forever and till it gets to a certain level. So a lot of the time I don't, you know, need to hammer things to death.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if I'm wanting to pull cymbals out and things like that, if there's certain frequencies, then I can do that with high, just adding some highs and some air.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more, you've got, you know, it's a real balancing act at my stage when you're trying to think about little instruments and EQing those instruments, because there's obviously everything else is layered on top. So you have to balance, okay, that's doing that to that, so I'm getting cymbals out, but then what's that doing to the rest of the track?
Exactly.
Is it now too open? Is it too bright? Yeah. Is it too annoying? So I'm really balancing it up all the way through, whereas you've got a lot more control and can go and can really nail in.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to know what, going back to the start of EQing tracks, how do you get those to, you know, if you're recording, how would you then record something, and what kind of EQ would, because obviously there's the slate stuff that we keep talking about and everyone talks about for mixing, and so that's kind of general.
Yeah.
But if you were recording guitars or recording drums, what kind of EQs are you using then, and, you know, and how?
I mean, straight away, the recording wise, I mean, I use the UAD stuff for recording, their Apollo interface, with like the Unison preamps, where you can kind of get plugins on the way in with zero latency. So, I mean, it's more like your style of EQ, where it's broader strokes, really. So things like vocals, massive cut in the low end, just to make sure I'm not picking up any unwanted stuff. And I'm kind of doing like mix EQ, but on broader cue points and broader sort of strokes at the recording stage. So I only really do have to fine tune, if anything, at mix stage.
So is that so that you can try and just capture as much information as possible and then correct it later, rather than trying to correct and get a mix kind of sounding okay as you're recording?
Well, no, I'm trying to get the track sounding as I want it to sound at recording stage. Now, for instance, if I record vocals, every time I record vocals, I've got a vocal chain, which is, it goes through certain things. It goes through an EQ where I take off all the low end from about 80 hertz, which is just like a low pass, high pass filter. Then it's taken off a little bit at 200, just to make sure that if the singer does go a little bit too close, it's not going to sound boxy, whatever happens. There's some compression on there. So it's basically, I'm trying to get the vocal to sound like I want it to sound in the track. The only thing I don't print is things like reverbs and stuff like that, because then you get into if it's not a good recording with reverb on it, there's nothing you can do about it to save it afterwards. You can't get rid of the reverb without using like that RX reverb, de-reverb or de-verb, whatever it's called.
And does everybody do that these days? Because obviously I go back to an older school way where people would record with the reverb on the track.
Yeah, I mean,
they wouldn't record it, you know, or, you know, they would occasionally, but a lot of the times it would be in there.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have, because you'd use a plate reverb from the studio, so you didn't have the option to,
of course,
go in. I mean, obviously you do now. So does everybody? So has it flipped the other way where everybody just records without any?
Pretty much, because now you've got to put it on afterwards easily. You don't really have, not everyone doesn't have a plate reverb. But I mean, back when they were recording the reverbs, it would probably be recorded on like an auxiliary channel. So you'd have the recording like just reverb as a track on the tape machine, you could lift a little bit. So the vocal would still be clean.
Flat.
But even then it was very rare for someone to record a microphone vocally completely flat with no EQ whatsoever on it. Like, there's no need to have low end in there, so you might as well get rid of it at the recording stage. Same with guitars. There's certain things you can do to EQ guitars. Take a bit of the low end off, give it a little bit of an, like when you said you're doing the 1K and mastering, 1 or 2 dB at 1K at recording stage is going to be perfect. Do you know what I mean? It's going to be really good, and it's just going to open it up for you, so you have to do less later.
So with guitars, how would you go about EQing those?
Mix-wise? Well, first it's getting the levels of the panning right.
What are you looking for? Are you looking for certain sound of those, or are you EQing against effects?
Well, yeah, well, you're sort of, it depends on the kind of guitar. If it's an acoustic guitar, if it's an electric guitar, like if it's an electric guitar, I would EQ it completely different, and it depends what else is in the track. If it's electric guitar, you're gonna have a probably electric bass. What were the drums doing, what style of music it is. Like if it's harder rock, I'll probably take a lot more of the I'll probably leave a lot more of the low end into the electric guitars. If it's acoustic guitar and it's an acoustic track, I'm pretty much not taking anything out of it, because the guitar has to take up so much space in the track, because you might not have the bass in there. So the bass has to kind of come from your guitar. So it really does depend on the style of music that it is. I mean, say acoustic wise, I'd probably bump it at around about, in the low end, sort of around about the 100 up to 200 mark, when it's just guitar in the track, because it kind of needs to fill that gap. But then if it's an acoustic guitar in a sort of a rock track where I've got bass and I've got drums and I've got a snare drum, I'm probably taking away there, because all that's going to do is mask that bass and snare drum. You see what I'm saying? So yeah. It matters what else is in the track. Like, there's no one way of doing guitars. You EQ it to whatever else is in the track. And obviously the level of it, where it's panned. If it was panned dead center, I would EQ it completely different to how if it was panned hard left and right.
Yeah, with mastering, I kind of, if I'm trying to bring the guitars out, again, like the vocals, it's nice to add in the sort of 400 to 500 range, just to bring out that kind of meaty low end. And that kind of just makes the guitar sound a bit heavier. Whereas a lot of people might think you're going to put it in to make the guitars more edgy, you're going to put it into the higher mids of 3K or something, but that's just going to make everything else really come out and hit you hard. So the guitar, to get guitars sounding good is, and to get them like warm and big and, you know, that kind of, you know, that kind of rock sound that you want, is to kind of thicken them up by putting more in the lower mids rather than the upper mids.
But then again, it's like, it depends what else is in that track. Like if it's a rock track, but you've still got synthesizers in there, if you're lifting in the lower mids, you might be getting in the way of what the synthesizer's doing. And depending on, again, the notes that are being played, if you want those notes to like harmonize with each other, if you're playing a certain riff on the guitar that's then mimicked within the synth, you need to pick what frequency area each one's going to take up if they're playing the same part. So it's a toss-up, really.
Sometimes you can get away with it, sometimes you can't. I mean, it's definitely track-dependent.
Yeah.
And I would say also, if I'm trying to look for snares and things, I would say sort of that's the only time I'd go to sort of a higher 3K or something.
Okay.
To bring out more of a snare crack.
Yeah, the cracky part. I mean, 200's always great in a snare. 200, sort of 175 to 250, that kind of area. Nice little poke. And normally
when you're mixing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can find it. You can obviously find where the snare is tuned to, but it's going to be within that 175 to 250 area. And just giving it a couple of dB on a quite tight cue, you can really make it sort of crack out in the lower end and give it a big, big punch. Like, again, it's something that a lot of students say, like, my snare, I can't get it right. And they're trying to go through compression and saturation, when really all it needs is a little bit of a boost in that sort of 200 area, couple of dB, and then it just cuts through that mix lovely. And then you don't have to go down the harsh compression route, because the more you compress is the thinner it's going to get. And it's just the more cracky you're going to get off the top end, but the body is just going to lose and you're just going to get nothing.
I think people don't realise that things get thinner as you compress them.
Yeah, the more you compress, the thinner it gets.
People think that when they compress, they're going to make it fatter.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of, because the logic says that you're pushing it all together and it's going to get thicker and bigger. But really, it's completely the opposite, isn't it?
As soon as you've gone past like 0.1 dBs of gain reduction, you're compromising the sound. As soon as you've gone past that, you're getting rid of the dynamic of the sound. And whether that dynamic's, like, there's a lot of 200 hertz in there, as soon as you start compressing, you are lowering the volume of that 200 hertz. Whatever happens, you're lowering it. And then all you're doing to make it sound louder is making up that gain from what you've reduced in compression. So it's like, it's always a compromise. Like, if it's subtle compression, you could probably make it sound fatter. But when you start taking off like 7, 8, 9 dB in a mix on a snare drum, you're going to lose all your body. There's going to be no body there. And then you're going to be trying to add an EQ beforehand. And all you're doing is making it thinner by adding more EQ because it's seeing more of that frequency and then pulling it down even further. So, again, yeah, it's a hard one, and it's like a counterproductive thing when you think about it. It's like the opposite of what you think it would do. But, again, it all comes down to the EQ of the instrument. Like, if your EQ is all right, you rarely have to compress anything. As long as you've got enough headroom and your EQ's sorted. I mean, nowadays, I hardly compress anything, which is gutting, because I've got a compressor at home that I made that I do nothing with now. Do you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
It sometimes runs through the mix, and if the needle moves more than it does when I turn it on, I've gone too far, sort of thing. So I'm using more sort of saturation-y stuff now, and like tape emulation stuff, to get the characteristic, but still keep a nice peak.
Yeah. Now, so if you're EQing sub bass,
yeah,
if you're doing dance music, and also if you're doing rock music where you've got a kick, you know, it's quite nice to add it. I find it's quite nice to add like 50 hertz or something, or lower sometimes, which just sort of really gives the whole bottom of the track a nice foundation and a push.
Yeah.
If you're EQing that within mixing, do you find the separations a lot better within the sub bass range? Because sometimes people will find it hard to separate the kick and the bass.
Yeah. If it's sub and it's like you're going to say sub and kick, the kick's going to be for me more in the 80 to 100 or 80 to 110. And the sub's going to be lower than 80. The sub's going to be sort of like 60 to 35.
But you're always getting crossover, aren't you, with those two?
So you'll get a crossover, but it's tighter cues. Like, as long as you use tighter cues between each and you accentuate on a tighter cue. Like, if I lifted on a very wide sort of bell cue at around about, say, what, 75, I'm going to be lifting sub and I'm going to be lifting kick, which is not going to be good for either, because all it's going to do is lift them both up together. Do you know what I mean? And all the stuff in between.
What type of EQs are you using on sub and kicks? What companies and what plugins?
Again,
kind of not just you, but you know, you obviously know what's going on.
Yeah.
So who's what people are using?
I mean, I like stock plugins for EQ just because I know it's ease of use and you know that compatibility if you go to a different studio. So stuff like the standard Pro Tools EQ, the standard Logic EQ.
But what do they sound like?
They're not that bad. I don't use them for tone. I use them more for the subtractive stuff to get rid of things. When I'm adding, things like the Pro Q2 by FabFilter is really good. And again, the Slate stuff, just the Slate EQs. Like, they've got they're emulations of like the Neve, a Neve and an SSL, and they're really nice. Like, and the good thing about those is that you're doing it for tone. So if I'm adding things, I'm probably using a third party manufacturer. Whereas when I'm subtracting stuff, I don't really care what it's going to sound like because I'm getting rid of that frequency. I'm not adding or exaggerating the frequency.
But I do find that certain EQs sound better subtracting than other EQs.
Oh, okay.
For instance, the GML sounds better if I'm cutting with that.
Oh, really? Could that just be the different style of the curve, though, in each thing? Like,
it's
getting rid of a different amount, even though the Q might be at the same setting as the Sontek, it might be at a different
But the Sontek's are more. The thing is, for me, the Sontek's are more creamy EQ. So if I try and cut with that, it doesn't sound as good.
Okay.
As when you've got a really sharp EQ like a GML.
It could just be down to the curves then of how they react, like how those curves are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that Pro Tools EQs are quite sharp and not characterful.
Yeah, I mean, they're clinical. They're like clinical.
That's what
EQ.
I'm saying. Which is what a GML 9.5 or 8900 are. They're very clinical EQs that are good on sharp cues.
But I mean, other EQs, things like anything from UAD that's like a modelled EQ is pretty good. The Marg EQ, Marg, you know the one I mean, don't you?
Yeah.
MAAG, blue EQ. It's like got the airband at the top. It's like 40k airband. Recently, this year at NAMM, they've just bought out like a rack version. Not like a 500 series, it's like a full 19-inch rack version of a Marg EQ. Those, again, the UAD version of that, really good, really good. Lovely sort of wispy kind of top end, hard to describe.
What about that new Brainworks?
Oh, yeah, I mean, for mid-side, that on a mix, I'll use I think it's the Digital V3.
Yeah, they've also got a new dynamic one out, which is good. Pan EQ, I think it's called.
Oh, that's crazy. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
It's crazy, where you could pinpoint something in the stereo field and lift it.
Yeah, a few mix engineers I know have been using that.
I'm sort of scared to use that, to be honest. Because I don't know whether I'd end up ruining something, because I'd go into more of a sound design head with that. I'll go into it and think, wow, that sounds amazing. Like, what if I did this? And I'd end up just